Hello and welcome to Technically Legal. This is podcast 86 for Tuesday, February 1st, 2011. I'm Dominic Raabe, and with me today are
Ben Snetkoff
and David O'Brien.
We've got three great stories for you this week. First, a university trying to assert ownership of an app and then backing off. Then liking and checking in on Foursquare and Facebook and rights to privacy. And finally, Freedom of Information Act requests being used as a method for spam. Let's jump right into our first story. Tony Brown from the University of Missouri came up with an idea that ended up with him creating an iPhone app that had about 250,000 downloads since he came up with the idea and implemented the app in 2009. He, along with three other friends from college, went to Apple's headquarters and got job offers from Google and other tech companies. So they made a little bit of money on this great app. The app was called Nearby and Newsy. It's not too important what they're about. But in any case, the university, seeing his newfound success, was like, hey, you're a member of the university. You should give us money, because, you developed this while at the university, and so we want 25% ownership and 2/3 of the profits. Please, thank you. And the university was immediately asked him for that money. He kind of was like, no. They actually did back off and said that he would get to keep his legal rights. But this story gives us sort of a nice platform to talk about universities and intellectual property rights, as well as perhaps employers and intellectual property rights. And any specific thoughts on this case?
I guess my first thought is that I'm a little surprised the university just kind of jumped at that without jumped to the demand of, I think it was 50% ownership stake and 30% of the profit, something along those lines, without really spending time to reconsider the policy about ownership of these things. So it's not unusual for, okay, I'm getting 25% ownership, 2/3 of the profits. It's not unusual for universities to have some sort of agreement with the professors who are getting paid by the university to do research, who are, you know, getting grants from the university and from the federal government to do this research, who are using the university facilities and, you know, essentially being paid by the university to do this type of thing. So the universities have an agreement where the university has a certain ownership stake in those developments. However, if a student is doing this kind of thing on their spare time using, you know, their own personal computer on the university campus, you know, with the university internet connection, that's a significantly less strong claim for ownership that the university has.
I think that's a great summary. I have actually worked at a university's general counsel's office for a very short period of time, and we had some experience with this exact issue, not actually with a case that involved students, but just thinking about policymaking in general. And this is something that came up throughout the course of like developing a cohesive policy for university-wide practices. And I was surprised to see that there were many attorneys in the room who adamantly believed that even if you're a student and you're using university resources, then the university has the right to claim some type of ownership in your invention. And I think the ultimate course of action that was chosen was actually that that might not always be the case, and it would sort of depend on a case-by-case basis. And I guess the way that you might justify even that that sort of leap in terms of ownership claims is that, just like you said, Ben, sometimes there are universities who are professors at universities who are using the university resources to develop certain things that a university might want to claim an inventive stake in. Sometimes that might extend to student activities, like students get involved in some way. Sometimes it's a graduate student, but they don't have that same contract employment relationships that the professor does with the university. And yet, you know, it doesn't give the students any more right to lay claim to the inventive ownership just because they don't have that same binding contract, which might, you know, require a professor to give at least a right of first refusal to a university. So I don't know, like, if any of us can really say that it's justified to what the university first claimed in this case, but I could certainly understand why the students felt indignified.
Yeah, there's actually a quote from one of the students who developed this app saying, you know, his first thought was, I mean, it doesn't seem fair, but they're a big university with lots and lots of money. You know, what can I do other than just say okay to that? And, you know, as you mentioned, luckily they backed off. But This strikes me as a university being kind of stuck in its ways, thinking that maybe not being stuck in its ways, just not bothering to reevaluate policies as new technologies develop and new things come out of what students do. I mean, I remember at the University of Rochester where I attended, there was a policy that you could not run a business out of your dorm room. But I'm sure in the past, 5 years, people have been making, well, I guess 4 years, people have been making apps in their dorm rooms and selling them. I don't know if the university's been tracking them down and, kicking them out of the dorms or making them pay part of their profits over.
Yeah, so there's actually some good arguments on the other side why a university wouldn't want to be able to lay some sort of claim to someone's invention. And that's if you have this policy that says just because you used our resources, we own a part of it, what happens then if a student does something that's infringing? Does the university then have some sort of liability if it's a copyright, an instance of copyright infringement or patent infringement? Something along those lines, or what happens if it's a invention or a business that's being run that injures somebody and eventually turns into a lawsuit? Sometimes it's not the inventor who has the deep pockets, but it's the university, and that would maybe give some incentives then for the suing party to go after the university rather than the inventor himself. Also, another interesting thing that I just thought of is that sometimes you get different benefits being a student at an institution in that you can get discount versions of software. Sometimes those are development tools, graphic design tools, or something that might aid you in the design or the development of something like an app that eventually becomes popular. So that might be another way that the university was originally thinking about how they structured these types of relationships with students.
Yeah, it's Yale University has actually tried to encourage students to do startups and do sort of things like this. CMU over in Pittsburgh has done similar things, but those universities are sort of the exception because a lot of universities still see students sort of as, I guess, indentured servants, someone to do all their work for them and not even bother getting paid or get paid very little. This particular case is interesting just because I think it was just a knee-jerk sort of automatic reaction. Oh, look, somebody has this. We should ask for money because they're a student in a university.
Well, look at Harvard and Facebook. I mean, Facebook is immensely successful. They have a huge valuation, and I don't think anybody has ever heard Harvard say, "Yeah, we own a stake of that."
Yeah.
That in stark contrast to everyone else who was involved with the early stages of Facebook, regardless of whether or not they actually played a role.
Yeah, I guess it's also worth pointing out that Harvard is one of the wealthiest institutions, academic institutions in the world, if not the wealthiest. So maybe they don't need the money, but hey.
So, this is just me spitballing now. Could there be any liability issues with the university trying to take some sort of ownership stake? So say that this app infringed somehow on somebody's intellectual property. If the university just decided to pick up an ownership stake in it without doing any investigation as to what the application did, would the university still be on the hook for, whatever infringements the app did or were caused by the app?
And that would depend, I think, a lot on the actual circumstances. I could imagine, though, that there's some clever attorney out there who will craft an argument that would say exactly that there is some sort of connection where you could, impute liability onto the university. But just on the basis of those simple facts, I think it's difficult. The closest things that you might have are contributory liability for copyright infringement or vicarious liability or maybe even inducement. But then, that's where you start to get into the fuzzy area, or more along the lines of those doctrines probably won't apply in this instance. Most of those doctrines require some form of a material contribution to the actual infringement itself. And since the students in that case seem to be the ones that were accomplishing it, I mean, the closest argument is that they're contributing by, facilitating the resources by which the students accomplish the infringement itself. But it seems like that's a bit tenuous.
Well, I'm saying from the standpoint of, suing YouTube. So say the facts in the YouTube case were different. The corporate entity, then known as YouTube, now part of Google, went and somebody acting on behalf of YouTube uploaded, copyrighted work to YouTube, knowing that it was copyrighted and illegal to make copies of that, did so without permission, then YouTube, the corporate entity, would be liable for the acts taken on behalf of that corporate entity. Likewise, if the application itself, in this case, that the students created, if that app itself infringed, say they stole source code from somebody, and obviously this is just a hypothetical, I'm not making that allegation that they actually did that. W would the university, now having an ownership stake in that, be somewhat on the hook for the I don't know, I guess there's a difference then between the corporate entity of YouTube and the students who made the application, even though somebody else has a ownership interest in it, because it's still the students who made it and not some sort of corporate entity.
In those circumstances, you usually first look to the instance of direct infringement, who's accomplishing the actual infringement, and then you can look to the parties that are sort of attached to that direct infringement in some way and try to get them. But then, I think it depends heavily on the facts, and it's a different relationship, I think, when it's just in terms of ownership like this, and it doesn't sound like the university was trying to claim full ownership. Not like they owned all of the IP rights associated with the app, just a part of the rights, and specifically, it sounded like they were looking for royalties. So, an ownership percentage, maybe.
I'm not clear what sort of grounds the university felt that they even owned anything of his creation. Could it have been just like, because you're at the university, you benefited from being at the university, and
Yeah,
having him be able to create this?
my guess is there's some sort of blanket language in some agreement that the students sign that says, if they created anything as part of a university project or while on university premises, then the university owns a stake in that. Without, I mean, that's my guess is where they're coming from at least. And they've since amended their rules to say that if it's part of like a university competition, then they're not going to claim any ownership stake. But if it's part of, university funded research, then the university does own part of whatever the result is.
Yeah, it mostly seemed to be a resources type of an argument. There was probably some sort of contractual basis for it, and maybe the like a student policy handbook. Those types of handbooks, just like you get at work, as you get your employee handbook, you get one as a student when you enter into a university, you get one as a faculty or a staff member, and it sort of governs the way that you're supposed to act in that capacity and all the things that you can and can't do, sort of. And in some cases, courts have held those to be contractual relationships on the basis that you're sort of accepting these restricted conditions on the basis of whatever value is being exchanged between you as a student and the university, or you as an employee and your employer. So that sounds like it was part of the basis. The other part of the basis might just sort of be this assumption that, hey, you're a student, you created something while you were a student, and we are going to assume that you did that using the university resources, and on the basis of that, and in conjunction with this policy that we also have, we believe that we own part of it.
On a side note, the thing I love most about employee handbooks being contractual relationships are the hoops that courts jump through to find that there is consideration for that contract. It's usually something along the lines of that by not resigning from your job when you get the employee handbook, that's the consideration for the contract that you're entering into when you're given the employee handbook. Because very often it's given to you once you start your job, as opposed to when you're signing the contract, if there even is a contract for the position that you're in. Right. Any last thoughts on this before we move on to the next story?
All set.
Be careful what you do and where you do it. You should always be aware of, restrictive clauses and stuff in contracts that might govern all the different types of resources you use as a university student.
Speaking of restrictive contracts, how about the Facebook Terms of Service, guys?
Hey now.
Segways. So our next story is about Facebook essentially re-rolling out part of the Beacon program that they canceled way back in 2007. So what this latest round of advertisements is on Facebook is that if you like a corporation on Facebook, or if you check into some sort of corporate entity through Facebook Places, Facebook will then occasionally use your profile along with some sort of sponsored story by that corporate entity. So let's say I've clicked like on Starbucks or checked in to Starbucks on Facebook Places. Facebook may on some of my friends' pages pop up a sponsored story that will say sponsored story with the Starbucks logo, my profile picture, and my name, and then some copy from Starbucks, 10% off on lattes if you click this link, something along those lines. Which raised some interesting questions about the right to publicity. So, right to publicity is a state-by-state law, varies on a state-by-state basis. They're always have a basis in state law. There's some kind of right to publicity stuff rolled into trademark law, but for the most part, it's a state cause of action, which basically says if you are, well, not even if you're famous, but you do have some sort of right to control the use of your name and likeness, so name and face or name and, general appearance, in conjunction with advertisements. So people can't go around plastering your face on an advertisement if you haven't given them the permission to do so. This got a bunch of people to thinking, when did we ever give Facebook the right to do this? And the answer is about May of 2009, where Facebook added a little clause to their terms of service. It says about advertisements on Facebook. It says you can use privacy settings to limit how your name and profile picture may be associated with commercial or sponsored content. You give us permission to use your name and profile picture in connection with that content, subject to the limits you place. Any initial thoughts on the terms of service of this new program, guys?
I might have just missed this, but are they also terming this program social ads?
I haven't heard that term, but I've only heard sponsored stories. But they are essentially social advertisements.
Yeah, so I just to bring up the terms of service in front of my face, I had to log into my Facebook account, and as I did that, I was searching for the terms page, and somehow I got a splash page put up in front of me that sort of gave a quick explanation of the new Facebook social ads thing. And I was then also able to change preferences on who sees ads that use my name in the ad itself. This is under account settings, Facebook ads tab. So you can set it to no one.
Really? I was looking for that and I couldn't find it in my privacy settings.
I stumbled across this. I wasn't even looking for it out, like I said, I was looking for something else completely, and here it is. And it says here, ad shown by third-party applications. Facebook does not give third-party applications or ad networks the right to use your name or picture in ads. If this is allowed in the future, this setting will govern the usage of your information. And then right underneath that it says, allow ads on platform pages to show my information. My options are to my friends or to no one.
Interesting.
So getting back to your point, though, I think that what this all relates back to is Facebook actually rolling out these programs with as a either opt-in, and they're not giving you an option to opt into something. In other words, you're automatically by default engaged in one of these social ad programs, or is this something that you have to affirmatively agree to or set in your profile settings before the ads actually start to roll out? And as you noted with the Beacon program before, that was exactly the problem they ran into, is that it was a default setting. Everyone was already opted into it. You had to then expressly opt out to going out to all of your friends on your profile.
My understanding is that the default is that you're opted in, but it won't associate you with any corporate entity unless you have shown some sort of predilection to that corporate entity, being checking in there on places or liking the corporate entity. So it's not like suddenly my friends are just gonna start seeing sponsored ads with me saying Ben likes Microsoft because I don't.
Yeah, and so actually, now that you mention that, when I stumbled on this page, I think it was set on default to allow ads on platform pages to show my information to, and then it says only to my friends. But then I was able to switch that over to no one. So that's interesting that the default was set like that.
I mean, ultimately, the result is that if Facebook doesn't provide the privacy options that people want, then people really have no option except for to sign off Facebook if that's something that they feel strongly enough about to sign off of Facebook.
Yeah, I have a friend who writes for a website, and he wrote a rather long post on that website about when he deleted his Facebook account. And the cliff notes of this was he signed up for social networking, and people kept on giving him stuff that he didn't want. Notably, all of these policy changes in Facebook and advertisements and things that, he didn't ask for any of those, and because they kept on being foisted upon him, he had had enough and decided to sign off and, delete his Facebook account.
Yeah, I mean, I personally deleted my Facebook account several months ago, last year. So, for the second time, I originally deactivated it in the wake of Beacon. And this is basically Beacon 2.0, I guess. Beacon was their original program that sort of linked in without any opting out. Say, if you rented a movie from Blockbuster, you would get a status update: hey, Dominic just rented Army of Darkness from Blockbuster. You should check it out. And.
Yeah, supposedly it would pop up something on the Blockbuster site saying, "Do you want to publish this to Facebook?" And if you ignored it, it would publish it to Facebook. And if you did not
Yeah.
ignore it, if you clicked
It would also
no, it would
publish it.
not publish it to Facebook. Yeah, a lot of people claim that they never saw those pop-ups, which isn't terribly surprising.
Considering they were pop-ups, yeah. So.
So, what bothers me though about when we hear of those types of beacon-like programs that suddenly pop up that everyone seems to be opted into without their permission. And I will recognize that Facebook has gotten better about disclosing privacy practices in some respects, and they have at least attempted in some areas to make privacy settings easy. It's that no one ever figures out that this stuff is in the terms of service or the privacy policy agreements until it's too late. It's no longer like an instance that you're actually considering what the terms are before you make an account. It's that you already have an account set up. You have all your friends in sort of layered into your account, and they're keeping you there. This is all part of the social graph, really. And then you find out that Facebook has done something that you don't necessarily agree with. You have to feel strongly enough and willing enough to give up all the value that you're extracting from having a social network page, and then leave Facebook. And delete your account, right, to the extent that Facebook actually allows you to physically delete your account. So in other words, it's not like you get to decide so much, or it's not actually, it's not like people are deciding upfront that, on the basis of these provisions in either the terms of service agreement or the privacy policies, that they don't want to create an account.
And as a side note, going back to what you were saying, Dave, I think there's a difference between the platform ads that you were talking about. Facebook platform is like the Facebook add-ons, and these new like and places based ads. In that, I don't think it's as easy to, or even that there's a necessarily a way to opt out of these new ads unless you just don't like things or check in on Facebook places. So I'm going to go unlike some stuff now.
Oh, that's entirely possible. I mean, it goes back to how confusing it is for a person to navigate all the various privacy aspects that you have on your Facebook account, stay up on them. And I'm not exactly what you would call a prolific Facebook user. I sort of sign in from time to time. It's more of a way for people to locate me from the past that are already in my network, not so much, for me to engage in a lot of different of the, wall posting and liking and all of that stuff that's going on. So I could have totally missed the setting from another change that happened related to other ad settings in the past.
Right. Any lingering thoughts on this, Dominic?
All set.
David?
Well, I'll pose like one last question to you guys. What do you think that the best approach is in terms of policy going forward? Is this something that we should have some sort of governmental entity looking into to ensure that, people's rights are being respected? Because as we started off, this really is a lot about misappropriation of commercial likeness. And if you've already contracted that right away, saying that it's okay for Facebook to use my image and my name for certain advertising things, then you're not really going to have any remedies at law.
Right. This reminds me a while back when I was on Twill, we were talking about something similar to this, and I brought up the idea of some sort of statute or federal regulatory authority, which was, at the time was kind of laughed down. Which is fine because at the time it was ridiculous. But since then, there have been a fair number of proposals in Congress for some sort of statutory scheme, if nothing else, to ensure accountability of websites for changes in their terms of service and making sure that their terms of service are reasonable as far as dealing with privacy and users' rights. So, I mean, I hesitate to say still that government intervention is the best answer, but it may be the most direct one because when you've got as much momentum as Facebook has, the market pressure becomes less. There's just you're going to get fewer people who are willing to pull the plug when, 500 million of their closest friends are also on Facebook. And there's, I mean, frankly, no viable alternative to Facebook until Diaspora actually comes about.
Yeah, what alternative is there?
MySpace.
No.
Friendster. Orkut.
Yeah.
Did somebody just say Orkut?
No.
Anyway, our next story.
Yeah, so let's move on to our next story. And speaking of This Week in Law and Denise Howell, Denise tweeted a story this week that was posted to WFAE.org, which is a public radio station's website in the Charlotte, North Carolina area. Just in case you're interested, the radio station does a lot of NPR and other basically public radio programming. Anyhow, so according to this article that was posted to the website, the Charlotte Observer, which is the largest newspaper in the North and South Carolina areas, has requested some 20,000 email addresses from the city of Charlotte and some of the other local municipalities under the local public records law. And so these email addresses are on file with the city government because residents can subscribe to an email distribution list and they can get updates for public meetings and other local government information. And after receiving the request for all of these email addresses from the Charlotte Observer, the city sent out an email to the entire distribution list and sort of warned them that this request had been placed and that they were likely going to have to disclose the email addresses to the Charlotte Observer, and that the subscribers might actually receive email from the Charlotte Observer in the near future. As you can imagine, the announcement sparked quite a bit of public outrage from all the people who were on the list. Now, when questioned, the editor of the Charlotte Observer promised that he was not going to send any spam to the email list, but instead he was just going to send a couple of friendly email invitations asking people if they would like to occasionally advise us on how we are reporting and what they would like to know more from their government and more about their community. Despite this, though, the person who actually had lodged this request for all the email addresses, it turns out, is a person in their marketing department, so I don't know how that quite aligns with what the editor of the Charlotte Observer has said. It does seem, though, that they are likely to get these records because North Carolina public records law doesn't necessarily prohibit making these types of requests for email addresses. This is a statute that's actually codified in the North Carolina General Statutes, and if you're interested, it's section 132-1 through 132-10. It's basically the policy under this law that the North Carolina government and all the local affiliates, through that, people who are residents in North Carolina can obtain copies of their public records and public information free or at a minimal cost unless it's otherwise excluded under the law. So it sort of works a lot like FOIA does, or the Freedom of Information Act. And the definition of public records, in case you're interested, is documents, papers, letters, maps, books, photographs, sound recordings, or other documentary material, regardless of physical form characteristics, made or received pursuant to law or ordinance in connection with the transaction of public business or any made by any agency of the North Carolina government. This basically is a very broad definition. Anything can be included as a public record in that. So, unless it's otherwise excluded under those provisions in North Carolina law, you can get them through public records requests. So, initial thoughts and reactions?
The
I
marketing
mean, it
guy should get
seems.
a raise.
Yeah, okay. I'll go with that as my first reaction and then chime in with the second one. I mean, it was a brilliant strategy on behalf of whomever thought that up. That being said, I think it's past time for that law to catch up with the realities of today and have it not include any sort of personally identifiable information. Well, unless there's some compelling reason that that personally identifiable information is relevant, especially if it's an email address.
Well, it's funny you mention that. This isn't really a new concept that people can lodge a request for information that the government has, and they can get personal information back, like email addresses. And in fact, in 1995, but maybe around 2000 or 2005, sometime in between those 2 years, there was a company who lodged a FOIA request for the University of Texas email system, all the email addresses within that system. And there isn't any exclusion under the federal access to information laws that prohibits disclosing email addresses or other personally identifiable information. And so they did, in fact, have to disclose all of those email addresses. There was a lawsuit after it, but I think it had to do more with whether the university could then block the sending of the spam that all of the people were getting, because I think the company that made the request happened to be at a website that did like dating services and that sort of thing. So this isn't new, and actually the Freedom of Information Act suffers from some of the same problems. There's no exclusion that exempts personally identifiable information. There is an exclusion that exempts personal or medical records of employees of agencies, and there's something that's similar in these North Carolina laws, but aside from that, it looks like you can pretty much request documented, personally identifiable information that any government agency has under FOIA and similar types of information under the North Carolina public records laws.
Incidentally, I would like to point out the sheer brilliance of the legal argument that a government entity placing some sort of spam filter is a freedom of speech restriction. Whoever thought that up, again, is somebody who deserves a raise. Although, I mean, in the end, this is commercial speech that can be regulated a lot more easily than other types of speech. But still, great argument that a spam filter amounts to an unreasonable restriction on speech.
You're talking about the arguments that were made in that case?
I'm assuming. I mean, that's a sheer guess. I don't think I've ever heard of that case before.
Basically. You're spot on. It was a Fifth Circuit case, and I can't remember the name of it right now. I want to say that the company involved might have been Buffalo Enterprises or something similar.
But again, so... you go, Dominic.
The University of Texas.
Yeah, so this would not matter for the vast majority of people. So private entities cannot be accused of violating the First... Well, they can be accused of violating the First Amendment, but it won't stick, because for the First Amendment to come into play, it has to be a governmental entity that's doing the restrictions on speech.
So the case that David was referencing is the White Buffalo versus the University of Texas, and basically White Buffalo operated LonghornSingles.com, a dating site for University of Texas students, and UT wanted to block them, and White Buffalo did a Freedom of Information Act request to get all the students' email addresses, which is pretty...
It's clever. I have to admit, it's kind of clever.
And UT got complaints, and they blocked them, and so White Buffalo said that this was they actually got a temporary restraining order, and they said that it was a restriction of speech, and it all ended up with, I believe, White Buffalo losing. Yes, summary judgment was affirmed.
So that sort of deals with some different issues that might be at issue in this North Carolina case here. Should it actually go to a lawsuit? I don't know that anyone has actually said anything about it going to a lawsuit or there being anyone filed. But the first thing that I thought of, aside from what might be exempted under North Carolina law, is does the Spam Act then apply if this guy gets all of the public email addresses of people who are registered to this list? Can he find himself at the end of the FTC coming after him for spamming people?
The FCC.
I think CAN-SPAM's FTC, Trade Commission.
Okay.
It depends whether or not he complies with the rules of the CAN-SPAM Act. And, I mean, I'm not sure what all of them are, but assuming there's some sort of button they can click for, you know, removal from the spam list within 48 hours and things like that, you know, my guess is they're going to comply with it once they get the emails, lest they get the strong arm of the law coming down on them.
So I poked into the CAN-SPAM Act really quick because it's been a little bit of time since I dealt with it. And Just as you mentioned, there's a couple of different requirements that you have, and one of which is that you have sort of an easy way to opt out, either by sending a reply email address or by clicking through a link or using something else on the internet that would allow you to sort of unsubscribe from the list. And the second is that, you know, the Can't Spam Act only applies to commercial messages, but not necessarily transactional messages or relationship messages. And those have sort of different definitions which have been ascribed to them. A commercial email message is any electronic mail message, the primary purpose of which is the commercial advertisement or promotion of a commercial product or service, including content on an internet website operated for a commercial purpose. So going back to what this guy said that he might use the email addresses for, just a friendly invitation asking people if they would like to occasionally advise the newspaper on how they're reporting and whether they would like any more information about their government or about their community. That's not quite, I don't know if that fits the definition of a commercial message, but I'm going to guess that this guy has consulted legal counsel, because it seems to skirt right around that definition of commercial message, because it's not necessarily promoting a commercial product or service, it's just asking for information. So in other words, you might not even have to have an opt-out link in there, or an easy way to opt out from those messages.
Any other thoughts here?
I agree that the law should be amended to not let this sort of thing happen, but I'm not entirely sure how it could be. Like, would a court have to make a determination for the use? Like,
oh, I would just say you can't get email addresses from FOIA requests. That's how I would amend the law. Because, I mean, what possible use could you have for an email address? What possible legitimate use could you have for an email address?
So,
I don't know,
FOIA,
it's like a government's conspiracy, and they email each other, and you want to see who's in another conspiracy?
The way that FOIA generally works is that it requires, and this is at the federal level, so it's different than the state-by-state freedom of information, access to information type legislations, but at the federal level with FOIA, all the U.S. agencies are proactively required to publish certain information, and there's a bunch of categories of them, to the Federal Register, and then for all the other information that is not proactively published, people can then request it, and then there's these categories of exempt information that basically the agencies themselves, if it's not within the public interest, for instance, do not actually have to disclose to the public. And it's stuff that you would, you know, imagine, or it's stuff that you would think would be there, military-related type information, NSA, FBI, law enforcement, types of items that are the subject of legal investigation. And what FOIA has generally done in the past, though, is that if you do request a document that has portions of information which fall into those exempt categories from disclosure, you can sometimes the agencies will just simply redact out the information that isn't fit for disclosure. And you could have similar legislation in all of the states then that requires something to that effect, that if you're making a information request that's either frivolous or, you know, doesn't have some sort of, you know, end in sight to the actual request itself, it seems like you could easily filter out that type of information. Or if you're making the request on behalf of a commercial organization, I mean, that's a little bit easier to get around, I guess, and possibly a little bit harder to track to see who exactly is making the request. But a simple exemption that says, you know, if the, you know, government so chooses, any personally identifiable information from the public, you know, will either be redacted or not disclosed at all. That would seem to fit the purposes quite well. Any other thoughts?
All set.
Okay, well, on that note, it's time to wrap up again. Thank you for listening to the Technically Legal Podcast. I'm David O'Brien.
I'm Dominic Rabier.
And I'm Ben Snitkoff.
As always, you can send us comments at podcast@technicallylegal.org, follow our Twitter account, which we'll eventually start using again, subscribe to our feeds online at technicallylegal.org. We'll see you next week.